Welcome to Philly Prime. I'm Dave Schrattweiser. Joining me this week is a good friend of mine. He's been on the show before. He's always a great person to talk to on some of these hot topics going on around the country in the Philadelphia area. Former Deputy Police Commissioner in Philadelphia, Joe Sullivan, used to head the Homeland Security Unit, SWAT, bomb squad, all those things, head of patrol, 30 plus years in the Philadelphia Police Department. Joe, welcome to the show again. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me back, Dave.
Good. Listen, this week, kind of wanted to catch up on a few things that have been going on around the country, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., South Carolina, and that's mass shootings or active shooter situations. We had a few in the last few weeks, just to list a couple of the New York City subway shooting. Suspect in custody in that case is a Frank James, who had some Philadelphia connections. We'll talk about that a little bit. A week ago, we had a shooting in Washington, D.C. It was almost like a sniper set up by the gunman in that case. And then we had shots fired at a baseball stadium, kind of young little league type area with ball games going on, guys fighting in the parking lot and 50, 60 shots fired, which left parents and children panicked all over the area down there. But Joe, let's start with active shooter situations, if we could. You had that situation in the New York City subway. Talk to me about when they get the call for this, they go to the subway, they enter the subway. Talk about the starting moments of an active shooter situation like that.
Well, it's absolute chaos. The responding officers have no idea what they're running into. In every one of these incidents, they are receiving multiple descriptions of the offender, so they can't be sure who they're looking for. If you remember, at one point, it was put out that the gentleman was small and 5'5", and he was a tall individual and an extremely heavy individual. So that type of chaos is going on. In this case, he utilized smoke to create confusion, make visibility difficult. So the officers are trying to do everything they can. EMS is waiting for the go to come in, but they have to wait until the police at least declare a warm zone. So there's a lot of radio traffic that always becomes a problem because everyone's trying to get on the radio. Yeah. That's just natural. And so once you are able to determine that there is no active gunshots, you can begin the rescue of those people that have been injured from gunshots, injured from trying to just to flee the scene. But it's organized chaos is the best way I could describe it.
Yeah. Talk about when there is still shooting going on, not this particular case, but when you enter a facility, a subway, a building, et cetera, and there is still shooting. This is a difficult decision for law enforcement officers, the first guys in, because sometimes you have to literally step over victims to continue to pursue the shooter, because as long as he's out there, he's going to continue to shoot. Talk to me about that kind of psyche going into a situation like that and kind of what needs to be your mindset.
Yeah, that's where training is so important, because you're asking police officers to go against their standardized training, against their personal morals and ethics, the reason they became police officers. And literally you have to step over wounded men, women, and children, because you can't change the fact that those citizens have been shot, but you can put an end to any additional citizens being shot. So it requires relentless pursuit until you are able to put down the shooter or the shooters, or drive them into a standard barricade situation at which time you can begin to rescue as quickly as possible. But that being said, the other thing that we did in Philadelphia and most major cities have done is police officers are part of the EMS response. Officers carrying tourniquets, we distributed 5,000 in the city of Philadelphia. Thank God they haven't been needed for an active shooter situation, but they have saved countless civilian lives, police officers' lives. We also distributed gunshot kits, and we initiated training between the police and the fire, because we saw in other incidents, beginning with Aurora, Colorado, what happens when the standing operating procedures of police and fire are not in sync with one another. And that's where the creation of the concept of warm zone came from. We can't guarantee it's 100% safe, but because we train together, we can get you in there and you can do the basic take basic life support measures and then extract immediately. There's no advanced life support at that point. It's just about maintain the airway, stop the bleed, and get the person out of there. If there's a chest injury, seal the chest wound and extract.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that New York subway case. They didn't have a lot of great video in the subway right off the bat, but they put some quick evidence together, video, all kinds of tips and leads and stuff like that, and actually led them to a U-Haul truck, which had been rented in Philadelphia. The suspect in this case is Frank James. He had addresses in Philadelphia. He had addresses in Wisconsin. He was apparently living out of that truck. But your thoughts on the NYPD and the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force and all those guys, even though this wasn't a terrorist action, according to the definition, but putting together the pieces after he escaped the subway, your thoughts on the investigative work done on that case?
Well, it may not have met the FBI's definition of a terrorist incident, but it certainly has terrorized hundreds of thousands of people, and it continues to do so at a time when we need citizens in big cities to return to utilizing public transportation, and they lack confidence. But you know, there is nobody better prepared to respond to an incident like this and to investigate an incident like this than the NYPD. And, you know, they have really fixed the relationship with the FBI, because you can't do something like this without them and the resources they bring. All departments are desperate for resources, are suffering from manpower shortages. So it's critical that everyone work together. And you just have to begin that painstaking process of begins with that crime scene. And you process every single inch of that crime scene. And what happens? They find a key, they find a credit card, and that opens up a whole plethora of information, which lets you know that he rented a van, that you can tell from the key what type of van you're looking for, and you can begin that process. At the same time, on top side, you have investigators that are just pounding the pavement, looking for witnesses and pulling all the video, literally going store to store, building to building, home to home, looking for Ring doorbell cameras, security cameras, municipal cameras, traffic cameras, red light cameras. So that it's like a puzzle you have to put together. You have all the pieces, and now you have to take all that video and link it together so you can follow that person's trail. And hopefully, in this case, they were hoping to catch him to the point he took the mask off, and then so they could utilize facial rec. Now they were lucky enough to find the van. I shouldn't say lucky; that was good old-fashioned police work. But they got the information out to their officers very quickly. So they get the largest police department in America is now looking for this van, looking for this individual. But they were also smart in sharing the information about the doer. Well, even though he's still a person of information, they got that information out, and they just created a situation that made him know that the walls were coming in on top of him. And that's why he made that phone call and called the police. And I also suspect he probably saw other people looking at him while he was having his McDonald's and realized that other people were recognized as well.
Yeah. And on the side of the van, obviously, is an address in Philadelphia. It's the West Allegheny storage facility where he rented the truck, which then brings the FBI, the NYPD to Philadelphia that night. And worked with Homeland Security folks here in Philadelphia, checking, I think, multiple addresses where they believe he stayed in Philadelphia. He used to live here till up around 2008, 2009, apparently, but they may have been staying with people leading up to this incident, and apparently rented the vehicle on a Monday, drove it into New York, and this occurred on a Tuesday. But he was apparently living out of the back of that van. But they spread out so quickly, and Philadelphia did play a key role in at least eliminating that he wasn't here in Philadelphia at the two locations they had him in.
Yeah, and the other important part about when they recovered that credit card, once they have a name, then they're immediately going right to social media. And sure enough, he's on social media with all types of videos that espousing hate for just about every group in America. But that also is an important lead. They can determine if he's subscribed to a cell phone or other type of electronics so that they can begin to track or attempt to track. So, you know, again, that's why it's so important that both agencies work together like they did in this situation, because, you know, the NYPD has its strengths and the FBI have theirs, and you got to put them together and let everybody do what they do best. Bring the ATF in, let them process all the ballistic evidence. Just let everybody do what they do best. And work under an incident command system so that all the information is flowing into one location. Everyone has eyes on it, and everyone is there are not, there are all decision makers in that incident command post so that they can make decisions in real time, share information in real time, and everybody's working on the same sheet of music.
Yeah. Would you call this kind of a textbook investigation? Kind of the way it's supposed to go, in the best of times.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, repetitions is what makes you good, whether you're talking about sports or responding to major incidents like this. And New York certainly has more reps than anyone out there. Their emergency services unit, their bomb squad, K-9 units, they're top notch. And the FBI in New York, and I mean, no one has done more homeland security or terrorism related investigations than they have. So that's why it's important that everybody work together in good times so that it's a seamless transition during bad times. And incident command can switch hands. During the rescue phase of that operation, it's certainly the NYPD and the NYFD that are in charge of the operation. But if this had been found to have been a terrorism incident, incident command would have shifted over to the FBI. But, the one thing that we've learned in law enforcement is the importance of cooperation. So either way, you're going to get everything the FBI can offer you, whether they're in command of the situation or whether they're acting in support. Can't say enough good things about my experiences with the FBI in Philadelphia.
Real early test for the new police commissioner up in New York and the new mayor up there, Eric Adams. They were quite out front. Your thoughts on how they handled the media in that situation? They were going public with information almost immediately on the vehicle, the evidence they were finding, then the guy they were looking for, then trying to locate the guy. Your thoughts just how they performed in the spotlight, a situation like that? Because as you said, that was total chaos when it first started.
Yeah, I think Commissioner Sewell's demonstrated that she's very good at messaging. And the messaging is important because it sends the right message to the public, but it also sends the right message to her personnel. She certainly has been going through a baptism of fire with losing officers and having multiple officers shot. But she has demonstrated that she's always at the forefront, the spokesman for the organization. And I think her messaging has been very clear and very genuine, while at the same time, she allows her subordinate commanders to do what they do best. Kudos, nothing but.
Yeah. And interesting. I loved her quote at the press conference where they announced the arrest that the NYPD made his world very small, very quickly. They shrunk his world. That's a great soundbite. Not that it's all about the soundbites, but for somebody in a hot position like that, right off the bat, having been in New York months, that was quite a comment to make. And it was right on point.
It is. And it really instills, it really conveys her confidence in the organization and the fact that she has the backs of her officers and detectives, and especially with a new commissioner coming in from the outside, that's really important. I remember her speaking outside a hospital when an officer was lost, and, I was very impressed with the passion and the heartfelt emotions that she conveyed, but while still making it clear that she was in charge.
Yeah. Interesting. I looked up some statistics. Since 2009, mass shootings categorized as four or more dead. This country's had 271 and more than 1,500 people killed and 1,000 people wounded. Those are the kind of numbers that make you want to train as often as possible and keep practicing and practicing till you get these things. As you said, repetition is the key to this whole thing. When you see numbers like that.
Certainly. I mean, it's critical in Philadelphia, we began training for patrol officers because in a situation like this, it's the officers in that neighborhood sector car, and cars, they're the first ones that are going to be going through the door, and they might not be armed and equipped the way we would want them to against someone with a long weapon or multiple magazines. Again, walking into a smoke where they can't see. So it's critical that they be trained. I had that training in Philadelphia. I had that training done by the SWAT unit. The officers in the SWAT unit, they have the credentials, and our officers believe in them. because they've seen the work that they do. So when they get trained by SWAT, they're listening, and I've got nothing but great feedback. But that has to be ongoing. I mean, you know, every year minimum, and it's difficult with manpower levels being what they are. But it's also important that that training be given to all of our partners, because we want to make sure that everyone's been trained the same, utilizing the same concepts, the same terminology, the same formations, whether it be a SEPTA officer or a federal officer that's pulling up with our officers. We got to make sure that they understand what each other is doing. But also, as I said before, you have to train with other agencies. You have to train with the Office of Emergency Management, and it's critical ongoing training with the fire department. We began training for all, and we did train all the fire department medics in the concept of responding to an active shooter system, an active shooter incident, and doing it in, as part of a combined team of police officers and firefighters, so that the officers can provide protection and let the firefighters do what they need to preserve life and extricate the victims from the scene as quickly as possible.
Yeah. We had another incident back down in Washington, D.C. I mentioned at the top of the show, almost a sniper type incident involving an individual. Four people shot there, including a former police officer, I believe, retired police officer who was badly wounded. I think you saw some pictures, the same pictures I saw, of the setup that this guy had in the location where he was shooting from, including a tripod and multiple long guns. All appeared to be capable of firing lots of rounds in a hurry. That situation looked like, again, another total chaos situation on the street when gunshots started to ring out down there. And fortunately, I don't believe anybody was killed. Four people were wounded, two of them critically from the last reports I saw. But your thoughts when you see kind of a setup like that, it almost reminded me a little bit of the Las Vegas concert shooting from one of the casinos. You know, tripod set up near the window, all kinds of weapons in the room. That kind of thing. Those things are just scary when you think about that happening in public.
Director Ray of the FBI recently gave testimony before Congress, and one of the things he talked about is the increase in assaults against law enforcement. In 2021, there was a 59% increase in the murders of police officers, with 73 of them killed. So far, as of April 1st, we have 101 shot, 17 killed. That's a 63% increase from 2020. But the other really striking statistic is 32 law enforcement officers were shot in 19 separate ambush-style attacks. And I'm sure that that was the intention of this individual to take out officers as they arrived on scene with soft body armor and nothing but a sidearm. They make easy targets for people like that. Right now, we have a law officer on average, a law enforcement officer is killed every 5 days in the United States. And that's unprecedented and a matter of concern, because if you take out the officers, then who's there to protect the civilians?
Yeah. Your thoughts when you saw that setup and those weapons? I mean, the police, when they did their news conference, basically showed the inside of that room he was in. Four people were shot. A lot more damage could have been done there to the public and as you mentioned, to police officers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I've talked about this multiple times. You know, there's always a criminal investigation, but I believe that, you know, as a country and as a profession, we once we do that, we really have to break down these incidents. We really have to look at, do a sentinel type review. How did he acquire those weapons? Did he do it legally? Did he do it illegally? How did that transfer happen? Was it a store purchase? Were they ghost guns? Were they delivered? By mail, there's a lot of unfortunate loopholes that need to be closed that allow people that are either criminals or they have mental health issues able to acquire firearms and firearms of that nature. You know, one of the things we never look at is there's a lot of talk about confrontations between law enforcement and people with mental that are struggling with mental illness, and certainly we're making great inroads and with co-responder concepts and things like that, but we're not addressing the real problem. And that is you can go back to the Reagan administration and you can track how much the population in the United States has grown since then. And at the same time, the number of inpatient beds to treat people with serious mental health problems has dropped exponentially. And that is a big part of the reason why you see these confrontations taking place. So if we're going to solve a problem, I'm always more than willing to let someone scrutinize the response of the police. But at the same time, we shouldn't always be the only one that have to answer for why situations like this happen. Now, I don't know if this involves a person with mental health issues. But New York City absolutely did. And it's something that if we want to put an end to these or at least slow them down, we need to. I mean, the FBI has since 2000, they've recorded 333 active shooter incidents from 2000 to 2019 that claimed 2,851 lives. Or I should say 2,851 people were either killed or were wounded. And a recent NIJ-funded project, the Violence Project, has shown that the number of Americans dying from mass shootings is on the rise. They studied 172 mass shootings going all the way back to the 60s. In the last 5 years, an average of 51 people died each year from mass shootings. In the 70s, that number was 8. So my point being is that if we're going to reverse this trend, we have to look at it from every perspective. I'm a proponent of the Second Amendment. I'm not trying to take any law-abiding citizens' guns away, but guns are getting into the hands of the wrong people. And I think all keep our minds open and let's really look at this without any agenda. Let's look at some of these things. And ghost guns are an emerging problem here in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Police Department, I believe, just this year has recovered 142 of those.
Yeah, the numbers from 2019 to 2020 to 2021 jumped fairly significantly. I think it was from somewhere in the 90s in 2019 to 180 or so in 2020, jumped up to like almost 400 in 2021. The numbers are big this year. I know, the NRA and others will, make the argument that the ghost gun thing is not a crime problem. It is a crime problem because they're turning up all over the city. A lot of the district captains in Philadelphia like to put out pictures of the guns they seize, and 6,000 guns last year seized in Philadelphia. And they like to put out pictures, and you see those ghost guns pretty much all the time. You have the Attorney General's Gun Strike Force, which routinely comes across in ghost gun investigations, 20, 30 boxes in a house where ghost guns have been assembled that were ordered online and then are being sold on the street. So clearly, if they're being sold on the street illegally at that point and then used on the street, it is a problem.
It is a problem. And, my son is in federal law enforcement and, he's frustrated because right now the technology has surpassed the legislation. There's not even a charge in the federal code for ghost guns. There's a lot we need to look at there. And, this idea that it's just people enjoy putting their own guns together is just, that's disingenuous. I mean,
there are people who do.
Sure.
There are Registered. People who do. And that kind of situation, but you don't have to. You can have a criminal record to order one of these. You have to be over 18. I'm assuming there's no serial number. There's no way to trace the gun, that kind of thing. I don't think we're talking about those people, but to say that they're not being used in crimes, just absolutely not true.
Yes, I'm a gun owner and proponent of the Second Amendment. But if I want to order a gun from manufacturer, I have no problem having it delivered to my local gun dealer and providing identification when I pick it up. It's what I'm willing to do to help other people less fortunate than me keep safe. Because in a city like Philadelphia, it's the poor and disadvantaged citizens that are bearing the brunt of all this violence. And the other thing about active shooter situations that we know is that in at least half of those situations, the shooter gave some indication to a friend, family member, coworker that he or she was thinking about doing something like this. So, we really got to work on that, encouraging people to what signs to look for, when they leak plans, who to report it to. And the other thing that concerns me is the shooters are getting younger. According to the research, the active shooters are becoming younger. And that goes back to just being a responsible gun owner. In the majority of all school shootings, the juvenile shooter obtained the firearm from the home. And I think we saw that in that shooting that occurred over the winter in Michigan. You know, I'm a proponent of familiarizing young people with firearms and teaching them firearm safety, but that doesn't mean you leave a gun accessible to them. Not when they're young and, you know, they're not fully matured, both physically and emotionally.
Yeah. Let's wrap up our first show here. But I want to ask you, Joe, kind of from your experience, how do you see, you mentioned the incidents involving police officers being shot in the line of duty, killed in the line of duty. We've had some in New York. We had 10 in Wisconsin, in a couple locations earlier in the year, 10 officers shot, that kind of thing. Over the next 10 years, 5 to 10 years, how do you see that impacting people going into wanting to be a police officer? How do you see that affecting policing going forward?
Retention and recruitment is the most important problem facing law enforcement, policing, corrections right now. People simply do not want the job. And, you know, the reason I say that that is most important is that you might say to me, well, why isn't money, you say that's crime? Because we can't address crime without bodies. We can't effectively address crime without a sufficient number of bodies. So and we can't rebuild trust within the community. We can't form positive relationships with the community if we don't have the officers to do it. So, you know, right now, I don't think there's a department that is in more dire need of officers than Philadelphia. I don't even think we know what that true number is, but, I know from speaking on a daily basis to people in the department, and they tell me, you know, about some of the nights, the amount of officers they go onto the street with, and it's really, really scary. And, you know, we're the poorest city in America. And one thing that we know from research, and I'll quote, Thomas Apt, here, sometimes we think that if you bring the economy back, the safety will come. It's the opposite. We have to make a city safe before people will invest in those neighborhoods and bring positive economic change and opportunity for people living in them. So if we're unable to do that, we're going to continue to be the poorest city in America. And that situation will even get worse for the people that are already suffering and in need.
Okay. Listen, that's a good way to jump into what we're going to talk about next week. Philadelphia Congressman Dwight Evans last week introduced a $51 billion plan, 10.7 to 10-point plan on dealing with violence, which includes more money for the police and a lot of other things. We're going to talk about that on the next show and some things that are going on in Philadelphia policing right now to try and cut down on the violence, cut down on the shootings, that kind of thing. So we're going to talk to former Deputy Commissioner Joe Sullivan again next week. Joe, I appreciate you coming on this week and look forward to part two. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure, Dick.
All right, that's Philly Prime for this week. Stay tuned. Come back and hear Joe Sullivan again on some of these new programs that are going into effect. He has a program that he does, Families Behind the Badge, that has supported some programs for youth in Philadelphia, especially in Southwest Philadelphia, stepped up when they needed uniforms and footballs and basketballs and things like that to keep kids at the rec centers. Joe, that's a great, great thing. And we'll talk about that next week. Thanks again for coming on the show. Folks, thanks for listening to Philly Prime. We'll see you next time.